The system. When you hear something, you will forget it. When you see something, you will remember it. But only when you do something will you understand it. An old Chinese proverb. What was the inspiration for this system? Well, when I started my second degree, I knew that unless I passed each year, I wouldn't have enough money to allow me to complete the course. I was working part-time during the year and also had a regular full-time job in the mid-year and the end-of-the-year holidays. But because I was living away from home on the university campus, my expenses were only just covered by my income. As it was, I only had enough money to get me through 1 year of university. I decided to worry about where the money would come from for the remaining 2 years of the course after I had completed the first year. I had made up my mind to devote 100% of the effort to the second chance I had for a future, and I addressed the barrier that my finances presented to achieving this future. There was only one barrier left, exams. If I could manage to break through that, then I would have what I was working so hard to achieve. I thought about my old study methods and how I'd read all the how-to-study books. Since they hadn't helped me in my first degree, it was obvious I'd need to come up with my own system of study, which worked. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. I needed something that would break down the barrier that exams represented. Exams were stopping me from becoming what I wanted to be. I knew that motivation alone wouldn't be enough. It wasn't in the first degree, so why would it be now? If two people are equally motivated to chop down a tree, surely the one with the sharp axe will do it more efficiently than the one with the blunt axe. I needed to study smart, not hard. I observed students who studied incredibly hard, thinking that the time spent rewriting the textbook would somehow give them a better exam result. Usually they achieved only average results in exams. On the other hand, I'd seen students who studied very little, yet achieved excellent exam results. There had to be something more to studying for exams than blood, sweat, and tears. I decided to spend some time conscientiously planning on how I would study. I felt any plan would be better than no plan at all. As they say, fail to plan and you plan to fail. I also believe that studying for exams should be simple and logical. It should rely on the ways that we learn instinctively as we would outside the education system. As children, we learn at an incredible rate. This learning occurs naturally without direction from adults, just as it would occur, say, if a child were left to grow up alone. The child necessarily wouldn't learn the things that our education system requires, but it would no doubt learn and develop in other ways. The first question I asked myself was, how do we learn naturally as children? If I could identify a number of ways that young children learn, i.e., go back to the simple basics, and then I could incorporate these learning methods into my new study system. I came up with 5 basic ways. They are asking questions, making mistakes, feedback, copying, and repetition. After analyzing how children learn naturally, I decided to take this train of thought a little further and consider other circumstances where learning is involved. The most obvious situation where learning plays an important part is sport. This came to me while I was watching a boxing match on TV. The second question I asked myself was, if exams were like sport, how would I train myself? If I studied for my exams in the same way a tennis player would train for Wimbledon, then I would become what I called a mental athlete. I decided that the answer to this question was to train myself under the same conditions that I would experience in the exam, i.e., train with exam questions, practice answering them under exam conditions, develop exam skills, improve my mental fitness. The aim was then to combine the answers to the 2 simple questions I asked myself into a system of studying for exams. I wanted to incorporate the 5 instinctive ways of learning into a system of studying or training for exams in the same way an athlete trains. To simplify the analogy, let's consider each of the different ways of learning for tennis and for exams, as I've done in the following table. Let's now go through each of these different ways of learning in more detail. Number 1, asking questions. How do you ask a question in the game of tennis? Obviously, you hit the ball to your opponent and wait for an answer when the ball is returned. Hitting the ball is the stimulus, and the return is the response. This, in turn, becomes the stimulus for your response. In other words, a game of tennis is really a few hours of question and answers, a situation very similar to an exam, wouldn't you say? Admittedly, the answers are short, but are usually multiple choice, and if the answer is wrong, then you get marked down on the scoreboard. What do we normally call the combination of a stimulus and a response? It's called the reflex, and reflexes have to be trained, and in sport, also have to be automatic if they're going to be of any use. If you touch something hot, a stimulus, and you pull your hand away, a response, too slowly, then the reflex is too slow to be of any benefit. You'll suffer a nasty burn, but perhaps the reflex will be better next time. It's been trained. If in tennis you served a stimulus and you're undecided about whether to answer it with a forehand or a backhand response, you'll probably lose the point. The reflex was too slow and you need to train more. In exams, the same situation exists. The mental analogy is to consider the question as the stimulus and the answer as the response. I call this the question-answer reflex. If in the exam a question is asked and the answer or response is too slow because you're trying to search your knowledge for the appropriate information and then suitably organize it, you'll either produce the wrong answer or run out of time. Doesn't it make more sense to have the question-answer reflex already trained so that you have an answer already prepared for every possible exam question? As soon as the question is fired at you, your mental reflexes are so well trained that your answer responds immediately. You hardly even have to think, just like in the game of tennis. All the thinking has already been done in your pre-exam training, and your answer is virtually automatic. As a result of this thinking, I decided that I should train myself for exams in the same way. If information is expected to come out in a question-answer format, then it should go in much the same way. In other words, if I were being tested with question and answers, then I should train for exams in the same way. There's no point in hitting a cricket ball against the wall to train for a tennis match, just as there's no point in highlighting and underlining notes to train for exams. I modified my study method appropriately, and as a result, I changed into questions all the titles and headings in my notebooks and textbooks. These headings would now stimulate an active thinking response rather than only being observed passively as they've always been in the past. Isn't it interesting to observe that from an early age, when we begin to communicate verbally, we ask questions. Young children are famous for it. All you often hear is why, how, when, where, and so on. They're thirsty for information, and asking questions is one of the most natural ways of acquiring knowledge. The question-answer reflex is established at an early age. Then why is it suppressed? How often have you heard mothers in supermarkets say, "Stop asking so many questions," to their young, inquisitive children, or "Ask your father"? How many of us are embarrassed to stand up in class and ask a question in case we're made fun of? By the time we're young adults, thinking in terms of questions has progressively conditioned out of us. The teaching process as it stands today tends to take away our learning drive. Initially, as young children, we actively seek knowledge by asking questions. We've discussed how this appears to be innate or instinctive behavior. As we get older, we become a part of a traditional educational process. We change from active seekers of knowledge to passive containers being filled with information. Our minds, which instinctively began thinking for themselves by asking questions of everything, are suppressed by an overload of information. If we no longer ask questions and just accept everything as fact, the thinking instinct is eventually diminished to such an extent that when we leave the academic arena, we don't know how to think creatively or actively anymore. We've stopped asking questions. If we're told to do something in a particular way, we accept it instead of questioning it. This study system will reinforce the instinct of thinking in terms of questions. Number 2, making mistakes. The second way of learning naturally is by making mistakes. I'm sure we've all heard it said that we learn by making mistakes. Yet it's one thing to say and another to live by. How many times have you also heard, "Don't make mistakes"? Many times, I'm sure. In tennis and in any sport, mistakes and the resultant correction, you know immediately whether you've made a mistake in tennis when the ball goes out of the court and you try to correct that mistake the next time. This is called learning how to play tennis. In other words, learning is simply a process of making mistakes, finding out what you don't know, and correcting it. By the time you get to Wimbledon, you would have made more mistakes than you care to remember, but you'll be a very good tennis player. So we agree that the process of learning involves making mistakes. In the sport of studying for exams, when do we get the opportunity to make mistakes? Yes, in the exam when it's too late. What's more, we're punished for those mistakes by having marks deducted. It's also arguable if we do in fact learn from mistakes made in the exam, because we rarely have our exam papers returned so that we can see what mistakes were made. This quote by Robert Kiyosaki, a well-known author, sums it up very nicely. Our education system teaches riding a bicycle by lecturing on the subject for 50 hours, giving a written test, and then punishing the student for falling off. In other words, we aren't being given the opportunity to make mistakes and learn from them. I decided my study system should allow me to make as many mistakes as necessary and not be punished. If we consider making mistakes as learning experiences, then I'd have a study system which practices the art of learning from mistakes. Mistakes tell you that you don't know something and that you need to find out. Once again, we have a system of learning which extends even to the animal kingdom, which apart from being encouraged, is punished and suppressed. The alternative to making mistakes is, of course, memorizing, which is boring, is not a measure of your competence, and doesn't result in knowledge. Memorizing also makes you feel stupid if you aren't very good at it, and ultimately makes you forget how to think. Number 3, feedback. Feedback is defined as the return of a portion of the output of any process or system to the input. In other words, it tells you how you're going and is extremely important in learning. In such a sport as tennis, for example, this return of output comes from a number of sources, some of which are your tennis coach, the scoreboard, the spectators, and your own observations of how you're playing in the game. In music, for example, playing the piano, you get instant feedback when you hear a wrong note. The importance of feedback in learning is obvious if you try to learn the piano with your earplugs in your ears. In the sport of study, when do we get a chance to obtain feedback? Once again, in the exam, when it's too late. I must admit that some feedback is given in tutorials and assignments, but this only goes to show how important it is and that there should be more of it. We need feedback for a number of reasons. It gives us a way of measuring our progress. It tells us whether we're studying enough. It convinces us of what we know, which gives us confidence that we're studying effectively. It tells us what we don't know, thus identifying areas which need more time spent on them and those which have already been learned and don't need more time wasted on them. It helps us improve, and it gives us encouragement, satisfaction, and motivation by allowing us to see the results of our efforts. Feedback is extremely important when it comes to fear and anxiety, which often occur before and during exams. They usually arise from the unknown, in this case, not knowing what is in the exam, and also not knowing whether you have in fact learnt and remembered all the information necessary for the exam. Obviously, it's impossible to know what questions will be in the exam, although you will see in the system, even this type of unknown will be reduced. As for not knowing whether you've actually learned and understood all of your study material, this method will continuously provide you with feedback on the effectiveness of your study. By reducing the unknown in this way, the fear and anxiety which accompanies exams will be reduced, thus increasing the confidence and performance. There's nothing more reinforcing when you study than knowing that you've learned all the material that you've spent so much time trying to absorb. Feedback has been described as the breakfast of champions. This study system will drown you in feedback. Number 4, copying. I regard copying as identifying skills and reproducing them. Even animals will imitate older animals or adults in order to learn skills of survival such as hunting for food and obtaining shelter. If these skills are not identified by the more experienced members of the species and reproduced by the young, then they won't survive. We've all heard animals kept in captivity when they're deprived of learning survival skills. In most cases, when such animals are returned to the wild, they have very little chance of survival. In the same way, to survive exams, you must be shown the skills necessary to do so, and also be able to reproduce those skills when required. Consider the analogy of tennis once again. In this sport, your coach or instructor will show you how to play a certain shot, and you must try to reproduce it using the skills that have been identified. Your likely success as a tennis player is dependent on the number of skills you have and your ability to reproduce them. Your progress in tennis or in any other art is measured by how well you've mastered the skills involved. These skills must be first identified. How can you master them if you don't even know what they are? My point is that in the sport of studying for exams, the skills required are very rarely identified, and even if they are, how many of them have been mastered? How many could you immediately list more than a few skills that are required when studying for exams? In this system of study, I'll show you 24 skills that I feel are necessary for you to study for and be successful in exams. This system will also provide you with the means of mastering those skills to allow you to become a mental athlete or a survivor in the exam jungle. Are you interested yet? Number 5, repetition. The final technique of learning is through repetition, and it's really what we call practice or conditioning. It provides us with a way of mastering those skills which are necessary and conditioning us to become either physically or mentally fit. Would you expect to learn how to play tennis without practice? Would you expect to be a competitive gymnast without practice? Would you expect to be able to learn an instrument without practice? Then why do the majority of students expect to do well in exams without practice? Exams really test how well you've practiced doing exams. Please be aware there's a huge difference between studying for exams and doing exams. By doing exams or practicing exams, you'll actually be studying for exams. However, by studying for exams, you necessarily won't be practicing exams. The bottom line is, your knowledge will be assessed in the exam, and although you may have the knowledge, if you aren't able to reproduce what is required of you in the exam, then the assessment will reflect your exam abilities and not your knowledge. Einstein was a good example of this, as he was in fact considered a poor student because he couldn't express his knowledge in the required manner. I know of no other way to be good at something other than practice. Practice, practice, practice. Just make sure you're practicing the right things. practiced in sport is also called physical conditioning, a process in which you build up your physical strength, develop your physical reflexes, increase your cardiovascular fitness. All of these factors will have a direct effect on your ability and success as a tennis player. In the same way, you must condition yourself mentally for the sport of exams. After the skills needed to study for exams have been identified, you must practice and develop them until they're mastered. This mental conditioning process will build up your mental strength by reducing the fear and anxiety and increasing confidence. Develop your mental reflexes, for example, the question-answer reflex, and increase your mental fitness, hence improving your ability to perform in exams. The majority of how to study books currently available identify many study skills involved but don't show you how to practice those skills. On the other hand, the system of study I've developed will provide you with a way of practice of all of those skills so that you can master them and become a mental athlete. Now that I've explained the simple principles behind my system of studying for exams, are you ready to go through the 6 steps which will allow you to put everything we've learned so far into practice? Let's start.